Hello, I'm Curtis Bowers, and this is Agenda Weekly. Thank you so much for joining me again this week. I really appreciate it. Subscribers, thank you so much. We really appreciate it. Want to never forget to thank you for what you're doing to support us monthly. Those watching on Rumble, please like, share, and follow. That's a great blessing to us. Those that are listening on the podcast, we're back on Spotify now. And when they deleted all of our podcasts on all the platforms last summer, we had over 500 five-star reviews, and those were all deleted. So if you like the podcast and are listening to one of the platforms, please take just a few seconds there to hit the five-star, leave a review if you'd like to or whatever, but that helps us reach more people. We'd appreciate that. Those that are fasting, thank you so much. I want to encourage you to continue that. Those that are writing the thank you letters each week, please keep doing that. I know even if you just send two or three sentences to them about what you're thankful for that they're doing, it just will have a big impact on them because so few people get any mail nowadays. If you get hundreds of letters coming in about something, I think it really would uplift their spirits. Got a lot of important videos below this week that you need to take the time to watch. One is a short one on the Biden administration. Purposefully put, we know now from declassified documents over the last 4 years, over 300,000 children into the human trafficking pipeline for profit. And that's from a congressional hearing, the clip I have. And they're exposing that right now. They were literally selling those children into the pipeline. It's that corrupt. We knew that was going on, but when you hear it from your congressman that that's what's going on, it's pretty sobering. Also, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., he exposed in a video below some of the organ harvesting going on during COVID in America, not China, Red China or whatever, in America. They were taking organs from people that weren't dead so they could sell them. The human body is worth so much money. I know just a set of lungs, because I've checked on it, is $3 million right up front. You have to pay in cash before they even think about doing the surgery, and then it's another million or two for the surgery to be done. But so if you take that, livers and kidneys and heart and brain and all that, it's worth millions of dollars, the human body. And so that's why there's so much human trafficking going on in the selling of organs all over the world. I also have a video posted by Tulsi Gabbard talking about how she is exposed now and seen the documents that prove Obama was the ringleader of the attempted coup against Trump in 2016 with Brennan and Comey and all those people. But it was a treasonous act. It sounds like they're going to prosecute. I hope and pray that they do. Pray that they are thrown in prison. And so everyone will see America is about law and order once again, because all the treasonous things, the criminal things. Hillary Clinton, she talks about in the interview a lot of criminal things she was doing. She needs to go to prison for that. But anyway, pray about that, and hopefully something will actually happen. I also want to let you know we have attached below in our news brief a PDF from Dick Pence, a good friend of mine in Montana, and he took the episode from a couple weeks ago, the Communist Islamic Jihad of America, which we're having part two of that today. But he took it and wrote it all into a PDF, all the key points and things, because he thought, as I did, it was one of the most important episodes we've ever done for people to really grasp that. But I want you to download the PDF, print up copies of it to read, and read through it carefully, but maybe to share with others or to email to other people. He put a lot of work into that and made it very easy for us to influence a lot of people with the Communist Islamic Jihad of America, the facts behind that. Because if we stay asleep and don't wake the troops, they will win, period, 100%. It's crystal clear. And Diana West is the guest today. She's going to talk about that also, and some of the facts that are kind of hard to accept, but the way she put them, I'm like, wow, we are really in a dire situation, even though it seems like everything's just going great. The last week of August, the 21st through the 27th, I'll be touring around Texas, I think in 6 different locations. So I would love those that are subscribers in Texas to try to make one of those meetings if you can. And we'll have all the dates and times and addresses located below. But it'd be a lot of fun to meet you and talk with you for a little bit. Today, like I said, it's going to be Diana West, and she's a great researcher that loves digging in and looking kind of at the long view of things, not just what we're dealing with today, but going back and going, why are we dealing with what we're dealing with today? And you can kind of see the history of things, which is a great way to do things because it gives you sometimes a totally different perspective than what you thought was going on. The communist and the Islamic world, they both seek to destroy us from within, and they are succeeding. She'll bring up some points, and I know a couple weeks ago, John Quandola, he brought up some very powerful points from his investigation into this as an FBI agent. But one of the key things that Diana West brings up is they're trying to separate the Judeo from the Christian and the Judeo-Christian ethic. Judaism, of course, gave us Jesus and the Ten Commandments, which were the moral law of God. And then the New Testament gives us Christianity, then when it's all pulled together and we realize that the Jewish Messiah, Jesus, has come to save everyone, not just the Jews, and by his death, burial, and resurrection on the cross. But they're working toward world government with a world religion, and they're wanting to use the Marxist strategy, the Islamist and the communist, of denying our identity to slowly break us down and destroy us. And she gives us some examples of that. But I just want you to listen carefully, learn some more facts added on to what we learned a couple weeks ago, because this is a subject we really need to be knowledgeable on to be able to fight this battle properly and to understand who our enemy is and what they are trying to accomplish. But anyway, here's Diana.
I want to thank Curtis for inviting me to speak today. I've got so much to say. I've been actually doing a number of interviews and working on some essays that relate to the same item. That usually happens when I'm convinced that something is bigger than it appears and harder to crack and understand. And that is the case with recent headlines for sure. As we've seen this crescendo of controversy, first and most immediately over Israel's bombing campaign against Iran, finally and somewhat surprisingly, there was dramatically joined by the United States in the assault on Iran's nuclear capabilities. This is the so-called 12-day war that we were told almost before the first wave of Israeli attack jets returned to base. We were told by American conservatives, such as Tucker Carlson, that this would be World War III, thousands of Americans will die, etc. And this began this very perplexing to me, just watching it as a consumer of the sort of top line. If you're looking at the newspaper and you're seeing the two-dimensional aspect of the news, it was very perplexing. Why was this happening? We didn't even know what the Israelis were or were not accomplishing. We didn't know if the regime, the Islamic Republic of Iran, might fall. We didn't know anything. It was not time to comment, basically. It was time to watch and learn. But this became, in many ways, for Americans, this became the more important story. The debate, the controversy, a crisis that is tearing MAGA apart over feelings, support, alliance with Israel. And this is what sent me back to the drawing board, as it were, my old books. I have a massive library on the Cold War. And the Cold War is over, of course, as we all are told. However, the dynamics, the strategies, the missions, all of this affects us to this day, just as World War II continues to affect us to this day. None of this stuff just goes away because the Soviet Union changes its name to Russia when its structures, so many of its structures, remain completely in place, which is a story for another day, perhaps. But that's just, you know, history is a continuum, let us say. So one of the things I noticed and have been trying to discuss in the so-called public square is the complete erasure of Islam and the institution of jihad, the institution of the dhimmi, people of the book, meaning Jews and Christians, the book meaning the Bible, from any strategic understanding, any assessment, any reaction to these events, which are yet another cycle of jihad against Israel and its response. I mean, this goes back, we know about the Crusades. We are generally taught by Marxist professors that the Crusades was a violent aggression against Islam. No, it was a reaction to the jihad. Very similar. These things don't change. Again, history is a continuum. So the thing that I wanted to get back into the conversation was this understanding of why it is that when you're dealing with the Islamic Republic of Iran, for example, front and center recently, why it is that the Islamic aspect of this regime, which is completely oriented around Sharia law, is dedicated in its constitution to expanding the rule of Islam. I mean, this is literally in its constitution. Why this is not discussed? And that takes me back to something I've been on really since 9/11, which is trying to understand why we will not discuss Islam. Like Adults was my first stab at popularizing this idea in my first book, The Death of the Grown-Up. Back at 9/11, and for about 15 years, I was a syndicated newspaper columnist. I worked on the editorial page of the Washington Times in Washington, D.C. And so I was weekly and more than weekly struggling with this, after 9/11, very obvious suppression of facts, history, philosophy regarding religious understanding of Islam versus Christianity versus Judaism versus Zoroastrianism versus Buddhism versus Hinduism, etc. And if you remember a long time ago, around 1990, I would say, the Harvard professor Samuel Huntington made a huge controversy because he noticed and wrote that about Islam's bloody borders. Everywhere that Islam is in the world, the borders with its neighboring non-Islamic state are bloody. I mean, this is a fact, and this is kind of takes us into this area where we're supposed to not notice these things. That takes us into an area known, it's an Islamic system or structure known as dhimmitude. Dhimmitude being a name applied by a non-Muslim, a Jewish historian named Bat Yor, to the internalization of Islamic speech codes, which are part of the Sharia, the Islamic law, against criticism or discussion, factual discussion of Islam, which implies criticism from a non-Islamic perspective. Dhimmitude is this sense of submission, self-abnegation, silence that is absorbed and internalized but acted on by people who are not literally under Islamic law, but they are under Islamic dominion.
That's one of the most important points that she makes in this interview. Did you catch that? We might not be under Islamic law. We're not under Sharia law yet, but we are under Islamic dominion. Think about that. What does that mean? It's like if I ask you to go wear a t-shirt that said Muhammad was a liar, you'd probably go, oh, I'd be scared to do that. And you probably should be scared to do that. That means they have dominion over us already, where no one will speak against Islam. No one will cut down Muhammad. Oh, he's a satanic, evil guy or what. No one's going to do that. And so I'm saying the influence is already here, even with their small percentage of population in America. It's already, people are on pins and needles to not, oh, we better not say anything against them, which is ridiculous. We should be able to say something against anyone. But they have already infiltrated our society with the idea, we kill anyone that is against us. We will brutalize you if you don't hide in the shadows and not say anything against us. Well, we need to say no to that. But anyway, I wanted you to really catch that point. It's so key.
This was, again, something I explored for many years. I wrote a weekly column, as I mentioned, which is collected in a book called No Fear, which goes through chapter and verse on these items as they happened in real time and as I learned about them, because nobody is prepared for this. We're not taught about this, and this happened to be a subject. The impact of Islam on the Western mind became a subject of great fascination and frustration to me over these many years. And it would carry over into our wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and the Islamization of our military in these theaters of war, etc. So this is something I've been steeped in for many years and see again coming back in such a way that once upon a time we did have something of a debate over whether there was a moderate Islam. There is no such thing. I'll just quote the head of Turkey, Erdogan, who says, "Islam is Islam, and that's it." In other words, the effort to soften Islam by Westerners, moderate Islam, or to take the so-called extremist to describe the absolutely mainstream classical Islam jihadist, jihad, the rewards for jihad, etc., and call them violent extremists, in other words, completely cut them off from any connection to Islam, was ridiculous. And we went through that, all those different names, Islamo-fascist, Islamo-Nazi. No, Islam is Islam and that's it. So we had something of a public airing of this. And now it's not even mentioned. We don't even hear about the Islamic nature of any of these combatants in this age of jihad.
That, of course, right there was another key point. Islam is Islam and that is it. That's their top scholar saying that. It's not us saying, well, no, they're really, you know, barbaric and whatever. They're saying, no, we are barbaric. There is no moderate Islamic or peaceful version of what we are and who we are. And so when they say that, we need to listen.
So that was something I've been kind of working through again, noticing it's even worse the second time around, if you consider almost 25 years later, the second time around. But certainly, if you've noticed, we really haven't been talking about Israel for some years in this way. You know, I would say in the 90s going up to 2000, all the news, foreign news, certainly was dominated by this concept of the Arab-Israeli peace process. And it just seemed to be the only thing there was. And then during the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and I don't know, it seemed to kind of settle somewhat, even as we also watch the intifadas take shape, a different tactic, etc. But it's back in with such a vengeance that I wanted again to look at it from a long view. And so I'm going back to 1983. This was, of course, Ronald Reagan was in office in America. Yuri Andropov, the very influential, important KGB chief, was in the so-called the dictator. They called him General Secretary of the Soviet Union. And I mention Andropov especially because he was, of course, a mentor to Gorbachev. And Putin is very enthralled to the Andropov legacy as well. He would have been serving under him at this time when Putin was in the KGB. And Andropov is very important because it was under Andropov at the KGB that the Age of Terror was created as a way of the Soviet Union fighting the West through terror proxies, including the Palestinian Liberation Organization, headed by Yasser Arafat, and many other Palestinian factions, Sandinista factions, IRA factions, I mean, you name it. There were factions. This was something that was long denied, the connection between the Soviet Union and these terror groups. The hijackers, remember the hijackings and the bombings. And this was always supposed to be presented to people as organic acts of violence and political movements with violence, which actually takes the political out of it, but violent movements to effect change. War, that's what they call it. You know, asymmetrical warfare against large established nations. toward the end of the 1970s, it's kind of interesting. I learned that something. In 1978, Premier Begin in Israel comes to the world, has a press conference, and says, look, and he holds up a Soviet military school graduation certificate for a member of, I think it was the PLO, one of the Palestinian terror organizations, which, as far as I think it was in Claire Sterling's book, The Terror Network, which was a very influential book, it exposed the workings, the Soviet sponsorship of so many of these organizations. That came out very influential in the Reagan administration. I think it came out in 1980 or 1981. But she writes that this was, you know, that first piece of paper documenting what now we look back on and say, oh, we all know this. But there was a time when we didn't know this. So this was starting to leak out, but it was not very much accepted. But by the time we get to 1983, when Yasser Arafat is at the United Nations making a speech that I wanted to mention, he is essentially a Soviet client. And he is there to tell the world that Jesus Christ was the first Fedayeen, meaning Palestinian terrorist in my translation. This is an abomination to conflate Jesus Christ with terrorism, of course, but this is not a one-off piece of agitprop. This is something that has run through the entire Palestinian terror networks, communist networks, to this day. I think it was Linda Sarsour, who is a perfect example of that so-called red-green axis, in that she is a Black Lives Matter, Women's March, Palestine, Gaza, you know, all in one. She has also publicly in recent years talked about the Palestinian Jesus. I'm looking at an article I pulled up from the Jerusalem Post that goes through some of the greatest hits, if you will, on this usage of Jesus as a creature of terrorism, as a leader in the Palestinian side. Yes, a prominent Palestinian Authority official, so this would have been after the creation of the Palestinian Authority, his name is Saeb Erekat, referred to Jesus as the first Palestinian shaheed or martyr. I mean, this is the kind of rhetoric that is coming out to me when you pair it with Arafat as this Soviet proxy, I think becomes a piece of information that we need to look at in terms of the wider war on Western civilization. In other words, if we're looking at the sweep of Western civilization, Greco-Roman, Judeo-Christian, this effort to break off the Judeo from the Christian is a very important propaganda element. And it is something that we see, I think, in our politics today at a very rapid, toxic, and diffuse way. I think we see it all over, and there are so-called outreach efforts between Christianity and Islam that seem to be heading toward kind of a one-world type religion. There are Christian heresies going back many, many centuries that specifically break off the New Testament from the Old Testament. One of them is known as Marcionism. But going back to Bat-Yor, whom I mentioned a little earlier, she interprets this because, again, this has been going on for so many decades now. If we go back to the age of terrorism, which really begins in a big way in the mid-1960s, Brigitte Gabriel recently pointed out that when the PLO founded itself, or was founded in, I think it was 1964, Gaza was in the hands of Egypt and the West Bank was in the hands of Jordan. So this was never about, you know, so-called liberation of these lands. This was always about driving the Jews into the sea. I mean, that we used to be much more conversant with this. There's been so much layering on of propaganda that we even forget these foundational facts. But if we go back to this notion that is part of Palestinianism, cutting off the Old Testament from the New, cutting off Jesus and the apostles were Jews, you know, cutting this off and replacing it with the Muslim Jesus. This is civilizational stuff. This is messing with very big things. And I think it is something that we see, again, these signs of. Bat-Yor interpreted this in the Islamic context of this notion of dhimmitude, which is this denial of identity. Now, that may ring a bell with you with Marxism, right? Marxism is all about denying our identity, changing history. Just think of the statue of General Robert E. Lee in Charlottesville that was pulled down and then melted down in a furnace. I mean, that's just one of hundreds of instances of our history being literally erased, negated, destroyed. And with it, our identity. Because in the absence of that Robert E. Lee statue in Charlottesville and so many other places, just stay with the Confederate history aspect, the various cemeteries and monuments to war dead and so on that have been removed. What is left? There's these gaping holes of denial that are filled with Marxist cant. That is a real similarity with Islam, because when Islam, remember, comes to us, lucky us, in the year 800 AD, so we have 14 centuries. What is before Islam is millennia of civilizations. These pre-Islamic civilizations in lands of conquest are literally erased. And this is why you find mosques on top of Hindu temples in India, why you find the famous Al-Aqsa Mosque on top of the temple in Jerusalem. I mean, they literally build on top of what was rather than say, oh my gosh, you know, let's add to it, let's augment, let's put ours over here and celebrate what was or what we can live with. It's like, no, it's not like that. So by its own law, I mean, this is not a value judgment, so-called. This is just the way it is. So if we look at this and we understand it as a civilizational jihad, some would call it assault, that twins with Marxism, I think we come to something. And going back to Arafat, Andropov, 1983, and this shocking statement, which was not the first time, certainly was not the last, but it was not the first. Apparently, you know, this was a theme from earlier in these political terrorist groups or in the politics of these terrorist groups. We're on to something that I think is important to understand. And I kind of want to hop to some of my own experience in documenting the jihad in our time. And that took me to Europe, probably, what is it, about 15 years ago. I was really interested and remain in the rise of extremely brave, articulate, patriotic parties in different European countries that rose to the challenge of both the EU obliterating their sovereignty and mass migration, particularly mass Islamic migration and other third world migration, but Islamic in a very particular way, obliterating their country. So you had the EU Marxists taking away their sovereignty, and you had, you know, it's red-green again. You had the EU Marxists taking away sovereignty and control of their own countries, their own destiny, their peoples. And then you had literally what we now, I think, often think of as the Great Replacement by Islam and African peoples coming in at unprecedented invasion levels. And this accelerated over time. When I was looking at it, it's kind of interesting. I interviewed politicians from Vlaams Belang in Belgium and Swiss People's Party in Switzerland and Danish People's Party in Denmark. I got over to Sweden Democrats. I also interviewed a member of Lega Nord. I got around, and it was a fabulous trip. It was very, very fascinating and a wonderful way to travel, you know, rather than just being a tourist. It's always wonderful to travel with some professional reason, like especially being a reporter. I went to Molenbeek, which is a suburb of or neighborhood in Brussels that much terrorism, including the Bataclan terrorists, sprang from after I was there. People did not even believe me when I told them that there was this Islamic enclave, like you could not believe. It looked like Marrakesh or somewhere right in Belgium. I remember having a conversation with a member of European Parliament in Brussels in a beautiful, charming, open-air summertime dinner. And he had lived in Brussels for many years. He was English and giving me a lot of trouble about my attitude on Islamic immigration. I was telling him it was destroying Europe, and he was pushing back at me. And I was telling him, have you been to Molenbeek? And he didn't know where it was. It was 20 minutes from where we were sitting. Never heard of it, barely believed me. One thing I did with him as well and others, because I interviewed quite a lot of people, and I had a series of questions that I wanted to get answers to so I could compare and get quick sense of their attitude. So, you know, there was something on the EU and sovereignty, and there was things about immigration. And I also was interested in their attitudes on Israel as a foreign policy matter, largely because one of the big raps on these groups, they were being described in leftist media as Nazis, you know, standard issue communist attacks on patriots. You're a Nazi, you're a fascist. So, okay, if they're Nazis, they probably hate the Jews who live in Israel, right? Well, no, it was fascinating. They understood, they explained Israel almost to a man as being a land on the front line of the jihad. In fact, an important player in the counter jihad fighting their fight. In fact, I remember Oscar Freisinger of the Swiss People's Party, I wrote a column about this, discussing how it was that if Israel went down, he felt it would be much worse for Europe because the Muslims would be so emboldened by this destruction of this Dhimmi people, or they would like to subject them as a Dhimmi people. I would say there is also an Islamic aspect to their animus toward Israel because the Jews were a Dhimmi people who came back and regained their sovereignty, which is not supposed to happen in the Islamic system. So they believe that once something is Islamic, it is always Islamic, you have to take it back. Anyway, he had this attitude that was widely shared that Israel was an ally in the jihad, against the jihad that was taking Europe down. This was, say, 2008. Well, we see much more evidence of this now in social media anyway, even if mainstream is still pretty far behind it. And Tucker is far behind it. Let's be honest here. Tucker is supposed to be a big anti-immigration advocate, you know, of drawing the line on immigration, but he does not talk about Islamic immigration. That is very obviously and massively transforming every European country that suffers with it. So this to me is, you know, I've been talking also about the Islamic view on these things, which he has adopted. But there's another piece of the view, I think, that's important to bring on. So if we look at, you know, back at this notion that breaking Israel out of the Western forces, let us say, is a strategy against the West, weaken the West, I think we can sort of look at what happened with Iran and sort of say, yeah, I mean, look what happened with Iran. We have never responded in kind to Iran after numerous deadly attacks on our persons and military. And this, of course, goes back to the seizure of the embassy, the destruction of the U.S. barracks, Marine barracks in 1983, 241 Marines killed, scores of French soldiers as well. No response. You know, same with Iranian involvement in numerous other terror attacks on American installations. Khobar Towers is one. Another one of longstanding attacks on American servicemen in Iraq. The IEDs were coming from Iran, and there was never any move against the factories, even, that were, I mean, let alone trying to bomb nuclear installations. The factories are making IEDs were outside the American Army's purview. Why? Why? This is such a strange thing when you actually see that America has always, since Jimmy Carter and on to Trump, has always, at the last minute, or never even considered, has always ended up preserving the Iranian government. The Islamic Republic dictatorship, in a way. You can certainly read it that way.
The reason why America has never gone against Iran is because our deep state, our military-industrial complex, our communist apparatus is the ones that put them in power there. In 1979, the Shah of Iran, who was pro-American, he was liberalizing the entire country. If you see films from Iran in the 70s, ladies have dresses on down to their knees, walking about. None of them have all the garb on and all the stuff that they do now. None of that was going on there. And then Jimmy Carter, through the State Department, which is run by the communists, puts pressure to kick the Shah out, throw the Ayatollah Khomeini in there so that Islam and the radical nature of them would have a home, a homeland, a place to train and then get connected with the Soviet Union. That's why the Soviet Union and Russia today have such a close tie with Iran, because they're the ones, the communists in our State Department, put radicals there so they'd have a stronghold right in the Middle East to stir things up whenever they want or whatever. But that's something we need to understand. They want the tension, the terror. They want enemies all over. They want war, fear, and someone to blame when there are problems that they created, but they have a scapegoat. Oh, that's because Iran did that. That's why oil prices are high or whatever. It always, the more enemies out there, the more threats, the more fear we are in, and the more power it gives those who are trying to destroy our country.
So we have this bombing campaign that is really pulling the regime down from the top. And what happens after this Sturm und Drang on the MAGA right, led by, you know, your Tucker Carlson, Steve Bannon, many others as well chiming in? Well, Trump stops it. He brings it to an end, which is good in the sense, no, we don't want a forever war. There's no way Donald Trump would ever fight a nation-building war. We were never in danger of anything like that, given who is in charge, given who is commander-in-chief. But this was the fallacy that was being presented to people. But Trump seems to have been affected by this furor, and he calls it off even before the Israelis are finished with their targeted attacks on the regime, internal security forces, Khamenei himself, etc. And there were reports right after about numerous Iranians who had been encouraged by the bombing campaign and come out or had started disobeying the regime being rounded up and killed. So what is it all about, and why am I connecting it to such large issues? Well, I don't think they're looking for facts. They're looking to drive an agenda forward that I think really is as big as this idea of breaking Christianity off from Judaism, of therefore weakening Christianity, weakening Western civilization, and strengthening these forces against us coming from Islam, coming from communism. So I will probably let it rest there because I've put out quite a lot of information. I'm happy to receive emails. I'll give or comments, however Curtis likes to speak with viewers. And I, you know, if you want more reading information or just have a question about anything I've said, I'd be happy to try to answer it. So thank you for your attention, and thanks again to Curtis for this lovely opportunity. I hope to speak to you again. Bye for now.
If you do have comments for Diana, send them to theagendaweekly@protonmail.com, and I'll get those to her. But I hope you learned some things. Sometimes you might not agree with everything someone says, but you need to consider it, and you need to think through things, because it's a battle we're in, and it's not going away anytime in our lifetime. But I appreciate you joining me. Our verse for this week is 1 John 5:12, and here it is. It's one of the greatest verses in the Bible because it, in one syllable words, tells you how you can have eternal life. He that hath the Son hath life, and he that hath not the Son of God hath not life. It's that simple. If you have Jesus, you have everything. And if you don't have Jesus, it doesn't matter what false religion you're in, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, atheist, agnostics, or some other religion, it doesn't matter. You're lost, and you're going to get what you deserve when you stand before God one day on Judgment Day. But if you have the Son, He will give you life. Again, I want to thank you so much for joining me. Those in Texas, I hope you'll take a look at those dates below and figure out which one you can come and join me. It would be such a pleasure to see you. But until next week, God bless you.